This is the podcast where you can listen to my award-winning audiobook, But He Spit in My Coffee. I'm Carrie Williams, the author. Cindy Peller is our reader. If you haven't been with us since the beginning, I suggest going back to start with episode one.
75. 12 years after becoming a forever family. Devin is one of the most expensive kids in the county, at my estimation, costing Medicaid hundreds of thousands of dollars. James Jameson has been assigned to help plan Devin's care. The light turns green and I switch James to my Bluetooth. I'm sorry I can't be at the Agape Homes intake meeting. I try to attend meetings for all of my kids. Even though I can't make it, I wanted to catch up with you. In my mind, James is another person to get up to speed. Another person to convince this isn't all about me being a bad mom. Another person who's not going to believe Devin's behaviors are on purpose. And of course, his real motivation isn't going to be to get Devin the services he needs. It's going to be to save Medicaid money. James continues, "I've read Devin's file, and it's one big file," he says with a guffaw. James is the first person who I've ever heard guffawing. "How about you tell me what you think needs to happen?" Well, this is unexpected. I clear my throat. He's gotten a lot worse in the system. He's become desensitized to violence. It's like he's got no upper limit. He might lash out and punch someone because he doesn't like lunch or if a kid looks at him sideways. James listens attentively to my long, complicated story about how we got to where we are today. I shift my car into park in front of Walgreens and try to wrap up. He needs treatment specifically for violence. I understand therapists want to work on the underlying issues, but Devin will be 18 in a couple years. There's got to be a way to help kids be less violent. After a foreboding pause, James says, "I used to work in juvenile justice. Unfortunately, that's where violent kids end up. The system doesn't have any good solutions for these kids. I don't mean to scare you, but that's the reality." I'm not scared. I'm relieved that someone else recognizes this terrible path we are on. James says he doesn't know of any program specifically designed to address violence in youth, but he'll look into it and get back to me. When we end the call, I head into Walgreens. My phone rings. It's my mom.
"You didn't have to pick Devin up to move him to the new place?" she asks.
"No, the PRTF staff is transporting him. I told you, I don't feel safe spending time alone with him."
"I feel so badly for him. It must be terrible living in those awful places.
I'm sure the people there are not very nice to him." "You know, he's not very nice to them either," I say wryly.
"He's still just a kid."
"Yeah, well, people would be nicer to him if he acted better. That's just how the world works, and he better figure that out."
I still wonder if it might be a good idea for me to let him come stay with me for the summer. I can give him the one-on-one attention he's always craved."
I put my phone on mute. She still thinks Devin's behavior is all my fault, even though he's had the same problems at every single facility he's been in. I sort through the Axe products, finding shampoo, deodorant, and cologne, all sandalwood, and put them in my basket. I'm not sure Devin likes that scent, but I am sure he likes matching sets.
"Anyway, honey, I guess you can think about if that might work next summer,"
Mom is saying when I focus back on our conversation. I unmute my phone. I'd have to discharge him, and then I probably couldn't get him back into care. Remember how long it took me the first time? In the snack aisle, my eyes roam over shelves. It's been so long since Devin lived at home that I'm not sure what he likes.
"Mom, you do realize he's almost 16. "I can't believe how grown up all the kids are."
"No, I mean that when Devin turns 16, there's a good chance of him getting arrested." Mom sucks in a shocked breath as I continue. "You do realize that he's committing actual crimes?
He's assaulting people and vandalizing property. The only reason he doesn't have charges is that he's in these facilities. If he'd been living at home, he probably would have been arrested a long time ago. Dear God, I certainly hope not, Mom says. That wouldn't help him at all. When I don't respond, she says wistfully, I hope they'll be nice to him at this new place. I hope they'll focus on getting him ready for adulthood. He's been living in a bubble where he's had no consequences for far too long. Grabbing a can of Pepsi and a bag of Doritos, I head for the registers. What are you going to do with him when he turns 18? Mom asks. I want to help him get an occupational diploma before then. That way he can get a job. My backup plan is to send him to Sarah when he turns 18. She'd be happy to let him live with her, and I could help pay for their housing. That would be wonderful, Mom gushes. She's the one person who loves that poor kid. Everyone in this world needs someone who loves them. My chest tightens defensively against her words, which are like pounding fists knocking the wind out of me. I look down at my card of gifts for Devon and know in my heart that even my best will never be enough. Mom says, When you see Devon, give him a hug for me. Tell him Grammy loves him and that I'm worried about him. I have to go, Mom. The intake is in a few minutes and I'm going to be late. When I enter the conference room a few minutes later, I am late, but have a Dunkin' Donuts coffee in my hand. Devon has not arrived yet. Mr. Anil, the program director at Agape Houses, is a lanky man with a long face and stringy beard. Mr. Thomas is the manager of the specific Agape group home where Devon will be living. His six-foot muscular frame is splayed out on a chair. Mrs. Williams, I want to talk with you about visits and clarify some of the information I received. Mr. Anil speaks slowly and steeples his long, elegant fingers, which are stacked with silver rings. I was told you're not open to having home visits, which is a problem, since the goal is for Devon to transition back home. Having home visits is an important part of that. He is also legally entitled to 2 days of therapeutic leave a month. Leaning back in my chair, I compose my thoughts into a palatable answer. I want to have home visits, but I'm concerned about false allegations. If he made allegations against me or my husband, we could lose our other kids. I can't risk them going into foster care even for a couple weeks during an investigation. He nods. We'll make sure his new therapist addresses this right away. Our therapist is Miss Jasmine. Curiously, he begins jotting notes on loose-leaf paper in a three-ring binder. We also need to talk about discharge planning. I understand the goal is for him to ultimately transition home. I have my answer ready for this, too. Yes, of course, we want him to move home. But I don't feel comfortable having him transition home directly from a group home. What do you see as the discharge plan? Mr. Anil asks. He needs to be living in a foster home with younger siblings and not have had suicidal ideations or physical aggression for 3 months. This plan effectively punts the ball at least a full year down the road, edging Devon ever closer to adulthood. But it is the only scenario where Devon would actually be able to demonstrate that his behavior is safe enough to move home. It's a big ask. But what they purport to be trying to achieve through this stepped approach. It's also just common sense, and Mr. Anil can't argue with it. We run through a few other standard intake questions. The answers are on the tip of my tongue. His dad is not involved in his treatment because he doesn't believe in mental illness. Devon has no physical health issues, although from time to time he claims to have asthma. Please don't encourage that. I'm flexible and can start family therapy anytime. I'd like to go to any doctor or dentist appointments. Yes, I know parents don't usually attend appointments, and staff take care of that, But if the plan is for him to return home, don't you think I should be involved?
No, he doesn't have an inhaler.
No, he has never been prescribed one.
Again, he does not have asthma. Devon hasn't arrived by the time the meeting ends, and Mr. Anil encourages me not to wait. He feels it would be less disruptive for Devon to go straight into their orientation period without seeing me, a reminder of home. I leave the shopping bag of goodies with Mr. Thomas, who assures me that he'll pass them along to Devon. While driving home, I call Becky. I just left Agape Houses.
What did you think?
They seem nice, she asks.
Did you see Devon?
No, he was running late. Before going over there, I talked to Mom. You won't believe what she said.
I bet I will.
76. Devon refuses to follow even basic rules at Agape Houses. Doesn't matter what it is. If it's a rule, he's not going to cooperate. He's restrained at least a couple of times per week, sometimes a couple times a day. He refuses to shower, complaining of bugs in the bathroom, invisible bugs that no one else can see. He breaks into the medicine cabinet to sniff other kids' pills. Nearly all outings are canceled because of his outbursts. The frustrated workers are at their wits' end. During one call home, Devon tells me that the workers won't let him have his turn playing video games. I complain on his behalf, hoping to ally with him. This is something I'm trying to do whenever I have the opportunity, like paying premiums on an insurance policy. I realize it's possible this dangerous teenager will be moving back home at some point, and I want him to view me as his advocate and not his enemy. I no longer call out his behavior, at least in front of him. My only goal now is to keep everyone safe, and that means if he comes home, he and I need to be on good terms at any cost. This time my plan backfires. When I complain, I find out that staff has been letting the kids, troubled kids with violent behaviors, play Mortal Kombat. Now Devon is furious with me because the contraband video games have been removed from the house. Then, on December 1st, like clockwork, Devon's behavior transforms overnight. He's polite, compliant, and cooperative. The staff can't wrap their minds around it. He's not just being good. He's being perfect. Mr. Anil begins discussing a discharge as soon as January, and Devon beams. I play the cheerleader mom as I'm expected to, but I know better. Devon has merely switched off his bad behavior in hopes of parlaying good behavior into Christmas presents. On Christmas afternoon, Becky, Jason, and all of the kids and I crowd into the group home. It's noticeably unfestive, with no tree or decorations. It feels even more drab having left home, where our tree twinkles, scraps of wrapping paper litter the floor, and the smell of coffee and cinnamon fill the air. Eagerly tearing into his gifts, Devon opens a football and basketball from Auntie Becky. I give him a set of Percy Jackson books and an art kit. Grammy has sent a dress shirt with a matching tie. Devon darts down the hallway. He returns with a tattered green and red polka dot gift bag. I have presents for you guys, too. Looking at him standing in front of me, I'm struck by how big he is. A man-sized boy. The gifts aren't wrapped, but he's used orange sticky notes to label them. He has a worn auto guide booklet for Sam and Daddy. Devon asks me to take it to them, and I tell him I will.
You'll have to share. You're twins, anyway, he shrugs,
handing Becky a 100-piece holiday puzzle that's meant for me, too. It has a garage sale 99-cent sticker on one corner. He gives Brandon a partially filled mini bottle of Axe cologne and Amayas and Kayla a comic book to share. The last gift is a crumpled People magazine. On it, the orange sticky says, to Mom, Auntie Becky, Uncle Jason, Papa, and Grammy. You'll have to share. He apologizes again.
That's okay. These presents are so nice, I say, meaning it. And look what I got. He pulls a plastic dome-shaped air freshener from the bag, the kind I use behind the toilet. Steph gave us each $5 and took us to Walmart. I got me a 42-ounce limited edition gingerbread air freshener. I hide my dismay behind a plastered-on smile. What 15-year-old uses his spending money on an air freshener? The kids go to the kitchen table to play Settlers of Catan. They're teens and preteens now, no longer the gaggle of toddlers we had when we moved to Charlotte. Brandon is the only one who is still a little kid. Amias and Abby share a chair. Brandon, hardly able to contain his excitement at playing with the big kids, hops from one foot to the other. Devin, Kayla, and Jacob have the other chairs, and Uncle Jason stands at the end of the table. Di click-clack across the table, often rolling across the floor. Becky and I refresh sodas, chips, and cookies. Mr. Thomas sits nearby at a computer playing solitaire and eating the cookies I brought as a gift for the staff. The other three residents have gone home for Christmas, and Devin is the only client spending the holidays at the group home. I hit redial on Sarah's number. No answer. She hasn't posted on Facebook since December 21st. I've left several voicemails and posted on her wall. Call me. The kids want to say Merry Christmas. It's unlike her not to respond, and I'm worried. The excitement around the table heightens. They holler and pound the table. Jacob wins, and then it's time to go home. Leaning one hip against the worn countertop, I try Sarah one last time, but the call goes straight to voicemail. Devin leaves a message. Hi. Merry Christmas, Sarah. Hope you're having a good day. Over the next few days, I try Sarah's number several more times. No answer. Something must be wrong. I scour the internet, knowing to start with crime reports. Sure enough, a news story pops up. Three suspected members of a Texas-based group known to steal purses from vehicles were arrested after a brief foot chase, police said Monday. I scroll down. Sarah's beautiful face is puffy and looks like she's aged a decade. She's been charged with three felonies, so I'm guessing she's facing serious prison time. My heart sinks. I'd hoped Devin might find a home with her when he turned 18. Unfortunately, that door likely slammed shut with her jail cell.
77. Did Sarah call me back? Kayla asks just before bedtime. I have some bad news. I hate to tell her this, but I don't want her thinking Sarah disappeared willingly. Looks like Sarah got into trouble. She's in jail in Texas. Kayla's chin quivers. What did she do? She had some drugs and committed grand larceny. What's that? I mentally kick myself. What a stupid thing to say. Grand larceny. Of course Kayla wouldn't know what that is. I start again. She stole from a bank. She definitely would have called you back if she could. You know that, right? Kayla nods and turns away, but not before I see tears gloss across her eyes. Late that night, my cell phone dings with a text. I reach blindly to grab it off the nightstand. The caller ID reads 911 Kayla. She programmed her number that way to remind me of the paramount importance of answering her calls at all times. Kayla. Mom, are you up? Me. You're supposed to be asleep. Kayla. I need to talk to you. Me. Can we talk tomorrow? You have school in the morning. Kayla. Stop using punctuation in texts. It's weird. Me. No, it's normal. Kayla. You're such a mom. There's a long pause and I put the phone back down. Rolling over, I flip my pillow to the now cooled side. I snuggle up to Brandon, who's better than a hot water bottle. My phone dings again. Kayla. It's too weird to talk to you. I need to text.
Me.
Okay. When I don't feel the vibration of a response, I squint at the screen. The text bubbles are dancing. She's taking a long time to type whatever it is.
Kayla.
I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm gay. I blink and read it again. I was expecting something about Sarah. I'm surprised she's randomly texting me after midnight about this. But I've long suspected we'd have this conversation one day. My finger hovers uncertainly over the letters on my glowing phone screen. Afraid to let the seconds stretch into a message of their own, I respond, "Me. I will always love you. I'm fine with you being gay."
Kayla.
Kay?
Me.
People have different feelings as they go through puberty. I think you should relax and take some time to grow up and figure things out.
Kayla.
Kay.
Me.
Have you told anyone else?
Kayla.
Everyone at school knows.
Me.
I will always love you no matter what. Now go to sleep. We will talk tomorrow.
Kayla.
I don't want to talk. It'll be weird.
Me.
Okay. Good night.
XXXOOO.
Kayla. Night. I lay in the dark, thoughts swirling through my mind. Moments later, the mattress bounces and Kayla burrows under the covers next to me. I scoot Brandon over to make room and lay sandwiched between the two of them. Levering up and resting on one elbow, I look at Kayla's face as she pretends to sleep. I kiss her cheek.
Mom! Stop that. Go to sleep,
she says in her best pretending to be exasperated but really loving the attention voice.
But a freckle jumped off my face and onto yours, I whisper.
She sighs. But in the soft moonlight streaming through the window, I see her lips fighting back a smile. 78. Sleet slices through the air, pinging off the roof of my car, and heat pours from the vents to defrost the windshield. Hushing Amias and Brandon, I answer my cell phone. It's Mr. Rob from Agape Houses.
Devin is AWOL, he says.
What do you mean, AWOL? You didn't stop him? Mr. Rob clears his throat.
No, we locked the door after he left.
You locked him out? My voice pitches with anger. Has someone gone out looking for him?
Our policy is to wait an hour, then call the police to file a missing person report. Eventually, kids come back on their own.
I hope Devin is wearing a sweatshirt. He's so impulsive. I imagine him leaving the group home wearing only shorts and a t-shirt.
Furious, I say.
Let me know as soon as he comes back. By the time I reach the group home neighborhood, the street lights have switched on and are casting murky shadows. I can't help but wonder why he's doing this now. Is it about Sarah's arrest?
The therapist told me not to tell him, and I haven't. But Kayla might have told him. Or if he looked her up online, the news story would have popped right up.
I watch to the left while Amias and Brandon watch to the right. But there's no sign of Devin. I circle back to the group home and see a police SUV parked alongside the road a few houses down. Stay here with Brandon. Lock the doors, I tell Amias, and leave the car running with the emergency brake on. I head toward the police car. The officers are middle-aged men who look friendly enough. Are you here about Devin? I ask. The kid who was reported missing?
Who are you?
The officer in the driver's seat asks. I'm his mom. He lives over there in a group home, but I have custody. The other officer types into his laptop, scrolls, and reads. He turns back to me.
The report we're here about is for property damage. There's no mention of a missing person.
You've got to be kidding. They filed only the property damage? I'm unable to hide the disgust in my voice. I show the officers several pictures of Devon on my phone, a seemingly normal, handsome, teenage boy. I give them his date of birth and my name and contact information. My teeth chatter. I'm going to keep looking for him.
Check the QT on the corner. Lot of teenagers hang out there. We'll put out a bolo.
My car is warm as I slide in and switch off the obnoxious, throbbing hip-hop music the boys are listening to. I circle the QT several times. When I don't see Devon, I send Amias in to check the men's bathroom. We check the Taco Bell and McDonald's bathrooms, too. No luck. Brandon falls asleep in the back seat, but Amias sits next to me in the front. He's wet and cold, but he's as determined as I am to keep looking. I circle the neighborhood again. We drive up and down the streets, my windshield wipers leaving a mucky mess with each swipe. Between that and the glaring headlights of the occasional oncoming car, I struggle to see even a short distance ahead.
You should let him move back home, Amaya says.
I wonder if he's right. It's been nagging at my conscience for years. Who's to say moving home wouldn't be the motivation that Devon needs to behave? It's what he's holding out for. Waiting me out. Refusing to comply with treatment. On the chance that Devon has returned to the group home, I swing by. To my surprise, he answers the door with a grin plastered across his face, as if we're guests arriving at a party. And here I was imagining him scared, cold, and sheltering in a filthy public bathroom. Turns out he was happily hitchhiking across the city and back. Now that Devon knows he can up and walk away, he begins to do it with disconcerting regularity. Each time I sit home, nauseated with worry, but I don't go looking for him. Where would I look? With the flip of his thumb, he could be anywhere. 79. I address an envelope and stick a stamp in the corner, then walk to Kayla's bedroom. Why don't you write Sarah a letter? I suggest, holding out the envelope. I don't want to write to her. She lays on her belly on her bed, playing on her phone, with her legs folded at the knee and swaying in the air. I'm surprised by her intense reaction. Sarah is a good person. We don't know the story, but I'm sure she just made a mistake. Why did she have to do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? Kayla demands. If she knows the time of the arrest, she must have looked up the news stories for herself. Thinking she's feeling embarrassed to have her mother in jail, I say, she's doing the best she can. No, she's not, Kayla insists. She could have at least done it in the middle of the night. I don't understand. What if she hurt someone? Why would she rob a bank in the afternoon? I mean, kids are out of school. Are you thinking that she went into a bank with a gun? Didn't she? Kayla demands. It wasn't like that. She went through the drive-thru and tried to cash a check that didn't belong to her. Kayla looks at me dubiously. She rolls over, sits up, and crosses her arms over her chest. I continue. Honestly, that's all she did. Write and ask her about it. My phone rings. I hand Kayla the envelope and answer. Mr. Thomas tells me that Devon was bouncing a rubber ball against the wall. They told him to stop, but he wouldn't. Mr. Thomas had to restrain him. I wonder how throwing a bouncy ball against a wall justified a physical restraint, but I wait to hear the rest of the story. A little while later, he found Devon with a t-shirt wrapped around his neck and his face was turning red. After removing the shirt, they took him to Eastside. I'll come down, I say. Best you do, but no rush, Mr. Thomas drawls. Looks like it's going to be a long wait. Has he seen anyone yet? Yeah, they're not going to admit him. The doctor here, a Dr. Alexandria, she said she knows him.
Says he don't need to be admitted. He's just acting out to get to the hospital.
I hang up and return my attention to Kayla. The envelope lays next to her on the bed, and she's focused back on her phone again.
Listen, Kayla, maybe this summer we can go visit Sarah at the jail if she's still there. Think about it, okay?
A couple of hours later, I back down the driveway on my way to Eastside and notice the mailbox flag is up. And no, Kayla must have decided to write to Sarah after all. I find Mr. Thomas in the waiting room, slouched in a chair, his long legs extended and crossed at the ankles. I sit opposite him.
Do you think he was really trying to hurt himself this time?
I don't know. He was laughing one minute, then twisting the shirt around his neck the next.
Mr. Thomas stands and pulls a pack of cigarettes out of the back pocket of his joggers.
You know your son. He's going to find a way to get what he wants.
Visiting hours are almost over, but the nurse takes me back for the last few minutes. Devin and I sit on two vinyl-covered armchairs in the wide hallway. I watch a young mother who is sitting a few feet from us. She's holding a small boy in her lap. Devin was little like that the first time we came here, too. Tears dribble down the woman's face and drop off of her chin. It's painful to watch.
I wasn't doing nothing,
Devin says belligerently. It was just a ball. Tearing my eyes away from the mother and her son, I focus back on Devin. I know it's a silly rule, but they're the adults. They told you to stop. You have to start following the rules. He grunts.
There are going to be rules you have to follow your whole life. What are you going to do when your boss tells you to do something?
He doesn't respond, and we sit in silence for a few moments. I say,
you know, every trip to the hospital extends your treatment. Remember? It's like you're going in a circle.
I make a circle motion in the air with my finger.
I don't care.
Well, I care. I want you to get better so you can come home. I find myself meaning it. But hopelessness settles over me like a heavy, wet blanket. A nurse comes by and tells us visiting hours are over. The young mother hugs her son.
I'll be back soon to get you, she promises.
I feel sick to my stomach watching them. She thinks her son will get better here. Thinks that they have the answers.
Will you visit tomorrow?
Devin asks. I stand to go.
If you're here, but I don't think they're going to admit you. If they take me back, I'm going to run away.
Where would you go?
It's cold out.
He has no answer as we walk toward the door. He obediently stops at the stripe that's painted on the floor a few feet from the exit. Patients aren't allowed beyond the line. He says,
I just want to go home. Give me one chance.
His big brown eyes are watery, and love for him burrows into my heart.
Devin, I say softly, if they can't keep you safe, how can I keep you safe at home? What would I do if you tried to hurt yourself? But I won't, I promise.
When I don't respond, he says,
please, I want to go home and to real school. The kids and staff always get me in trouble at day treatment and Crossroads Academy. That's the problem.
We can work toward you going to real school and coming home, but you have to cooperate with your treatment plan. It's up to you. It's like a game of Candyland. You just keep moving forward, and before you know it, you're at Candy Castle. Just follow the rules, and before you know it, you'll be home.
I hug him tightly and say goodbye.
This has been But He Spit in My Coffee. If you like this podcast, please leave a 5-star review to help others find it.